The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
It is The Hard Shoulder. It's Anton in for Kieran. The former Bishop of Ferns, Brendan Comiskey, has died at the age of 89. Brendan Comiskey, of course, resigned in April 2002 over revelations of his failure to address allegations of clerical sex abuse in the Diocese of Ferns. And he resigned in the wake of the Ferns report. That report created, in large part thanks to the work done by Colm O'Gorman, who himself had been a victim of sexual assault by Father Sean Fortune, one of the priests of that diocese. And what it revealed was hundreds of children who over decades had been sexually assaulted by priests who ultimately answered to Bishop Comiskey while he was Bishop of Ferns. Colm O'Gorman is with us now. Colm, in looking at Bishop Comiskey's culpability, was it that he tried his best, which was his take, and wasn't successful, or was he negligent?
Well, as a matter of legal fact, it's been established that he was negligent because the Diocese of Ferns acknowledged that in a statement read into the High Court in Dublin in 2003 when they settled my case, suing them for that negligence and for the harm caused for me on foot of it. So he was definitely negligent in a legal context. And first of all, just to clarify something, Brendan Comiskey resigned 2 weeks after the broadcast of a documentary I made with the BBC called Suing the Pope. And off the back of the public outcry following on from the documentary and then him resigning, we secured the Ferns inquiry, which reported a couple of years later, it reported in October of 2005.
My apologies.
No problem at all. It's a long time ago, Anton. But the point of negligence or incompetence, I mean, one of the things I'm concerned about is, you know, that history will be rewritten in a way that suggests that Brendan Comiskey was, you know, uniquely culpable, or that he was incompetent, or that he failed to manage abuse. That's not the case. I mean, what Brendan Comiskey did largely was he implemented the directives of the Vatican that required the cover up of these cases, the enforcement of absolute secrecy in cases that bishops became aware of. You know, victims, witnesses, others were sworn to the pontifical secret, which is the highest level of secrecy in church run investigations were put in place. The penalty for breach of that was excommunication. I revealed that in a documentary I made again for the BBC in 2006. And when we made that, we were attacked roundly as making all of this up entirely, only for 13 years later, Pope Francis to withdraw that requirement for pontifical secrecy. So Comiskey wasn't a bungling incompetent. He was a man who agreed with and complied with the requirement put in place by the Vatican to cover up these crimes, to above all protect priests who were accused of abuse, who had abused children, to silence victims and to protect priests, the church, its authority, its money and its power.
And can I ask, Colm, do you view that as moral cowardice, or do you view that as a lack of understanding of the reality of what was going on and the damage that was done?
So I don't know about moral cowardice. I certainly see it as a moral corruption, for want of a better phrase, if that's okay. I don't know whether it was cowardice particularly. The church believed absolutely, and I think still does believe in its absolute authority. So it doesn't see itself as needing to be accountable in the way that other human institutions have to be. So I don't think it was cowardice, no, nor do I think it was a lack of appreciation or understanding of child sexual abuse and its impact. You know, despite everything that cardinals and bishops and popes have been telling us since like the mid-1990s, when those of us who were abused started to come forward publicly and speak very openly about what had happened to us, the church has a very detailed and long-standing understanding of the nature of paedophilia. Like, the first laws were introduced in the Christian church in the early 4th century to deal with priests who committed sexual crimes. By another example of that, in 1948, there was a religious congregation called the Servants of the Paraclete established. The Pope agreed for the establishment of the congregation. Its only purpose was to treat priests who had psychosexual problems. And by 1953 at the latest, the head of that congregation was telling the Vatican and the Pope, the then Pope directly, that returning priests to ministry post-treatment was not safe, that they would continue to offend. He said something like, and I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly, to return them to ministry is to grant them green pastures to continue their wanton activities. So by the early 1950s, at the very latest, the Catholic Church had an understanding of the, at the highest level, at the level of the Vatican, had an understanding of the psychosexual dimensions of paedophilia, understood that treatment mattered and psychological treatment was important, but also understood recidivism and risk and that it was never safe to return priests to ministry. And yet, as we saw in Ferns, which was atypical rather than unique, it was routine for priests to be returned to ministry even after they had been referred for some kind of in-house treatment, very often in one of the institutions, which was in Stroud in Gloucestershire, run by that particular congregation. So
to what extent,
it wasn't a lack of understanding.
To what extent do you think, if at all, Bishop Comiskey's hands were tied? In that, one of the things that Ferns highlights is that, particularly in the early stages of his tenure, he had limited capacity to order priests, or at least he thought he had limited capacity to order priests out of ministry, and felt that he would lose the credibility of his own ministry if he acted too harshly. Do you think there's any, do you put any stock in that?
I mean, that sounds like a variation of the he was only following orders piece. So again, I don't think he should be uniquely scapegoated for following the church's rules, but he is uniquely responsible for his decision to do so. He could simply not have done so. He could have shown a level of, frankly, basic decency and humanity and refused to cover up these crimes. He could have acted to protect children. He could have responded to communities that were being devastated by this. The consequences of his decision to comply with the Vatican's instruction to cover up these crimes are just massive. Like, so many lives have been devastated. Lives have been lost. People have died because they couldn't live with the trauma. They've ended their lives because they couldn't deal with the trauma of what happened with them in the Diocese of Ferns. Again, it's not unique to Ferns. So the consequences of his actions, his collusion, his compliance with the cover-up, his protection of priests, his moving them from parish to parish, allowing them to continue in ministry, or even agreeing to their ordination after they had been identified as abusers, had devastating impact upon communities, and he is uniquely and personally responsible for that. But it's not that simple. Like, when we were campaigning, when I was campaigning for the Ferns inquiry in 2002, it wasn't because I thought the diocese was unique, but I thought the diocese presented a unique opportunity to get to grips with and understand the systemic issues at play here. We investigated, or sought an investigation and secured one, that looked at the response of not just church authorities at every level, but also the responses of state agencies and Garda Síochána, the health board of the time, what did they do on foot of these allegations? That was the first time that had ever happened anywhere here in Ireland, an inquiry like this. And it revealed the systemic nature of what was happening, the endemic nature of what was happening. And then we saw that that was common, not just across dioceses here in Ireland, but Catholic dioceses globally.
We've talked about the role that you played in the lawsuit, in the documentary that you made, and in subsequently as founder of One and Four and the advocacy work there done. You were also a child who was a victim of one of the men that Comiskey might have done something about had he acted differently. In that personal capacity, what's your reaction to his death?
I mean, to be frank, it's always a sad moment when somebody dies, and it's a profoundly sad moment for the people who knew him and loved him. And Brendan Comiskey had a family and friends who knew and loved him. So above all, I want to send my heartfelt condolences to them. This isn't about Brendan Comiskey. He was, to the degree that any bishop was held accountable, he was held accountable. I think he was the first bishop anywhere in the world to resign on foot of these kinds of revelations. He lived as a private individual for about 20 years. He was at one point effectively removed from ministry and had to practice a restricted ministry. It's not about him. My thoughts today are with the very many people who'll be hearing this news, for whom this brings up all of that hurt and pain. The families here in the diocese, and whether they're living in Ferns still in Wexford or beyond, who have lost family members who couldn't live with the trauma and hurt of what had happened.
But do you not carry anger
towards Brendan Comiskey?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I've moved very, very far beyond that. If I feel, I do feel a level of outrage today at how the church and the Vatican, and very often many commentators go along with this, still seek to misrepresent the clear established facts of what had happened. Where, you know, we'll hear things like, you know, how a pope has acknowledged failings. These weren't failings. This was the implementation of a willful, directed cover-up of the rape and abuse of hundreds of thousands of children and vulnerable adults across the world, directed and mandated and required by canon law, by the Vatican and in its policies and procedures. That has never been acknowledged by any senior figure within the Vatican, and certainly not by any pope, including Pope Francis, who died recently. And yet, very often the commentary is that, you know, great strides have been taken forward in acknowledging the truth of what had happened. Really good strides have been taken in terms of protecting children within the Catholic Church and beyond as a consequence of all of these revelations. That has been forced and things have changed there. But the simple truth has not yet been acknowledged. And, you know, for as long as the Vatican and whoever happens to sit in the Holy See, whoever happens to occupy the Holy See, refuse to tell the truth, which is now well established, we can't believe that things have changed in a really fundamental way. So that I feel angry about. I feel angry about the reinvention or the restatement of established fact in a way that just creates falsehoods. You know, moments like this are when history gets written, when people research, you know, let's imagine in 100 years' time, and I really hope this doesn't happen, these scandals reemerge again and people start researching. It's when they read stories about the death of Francis or the death of Brendan Comiskey or narrative or commentary on all of these. That's how history gets written. And sadly, history too often doesn't capture what's been established as a matter of fact, either in law or in legal processes. And that is that this was not what happened within the Diocese of Ferns, in dioceses across this island, in dioceses across the Catholic world, was not because of some individual moral failure or incompetence on the part of poor bishops who didn't handle things properly. It was a consequence and a result of a willful conspiracy of directed cover-up, dictated by the Vatican, required and underpinned by canon law, and enforced with absolute zeal across not just many decades, but centuries.
Although presumably
that may have changed to some degree, but the truth of that matters, and it has to be stated and it has to be accepted.
That acknowledgement that you hoped you might have happened at the Vatican level. Presumably now we are past the apogee of political pressure and public pressure globally, so the likelihood of that happening is now very slim.
I think the likelihood of it happening is very slim, but I'm more worried about the degree to which people from outside the church are prepared to go along with the line or accept, you know, that that's not the case. I mean, you know, again, I don't want to disrespect people who've just died, and I don't want to disrespect people who'll be grieving them. Pope Francis was somebody I admired hugely. I thought he was an extraordinary person on many, many levels. But on the abuse issue, he was fundamentally dishonest. You know, he came to Ireland and said he didn't know about the mother and baby homes and the Magdalen laundries when he met with survivors. That's a nonsense. That's patently not true. You know, he talked about the failings of church leaders, but never talked about the role of the Vatican. And again, they weren't failings. This wasn't some, you know, incompetent, you know, malign, negligent act. This was a willful, deliberate cover-up that was codified in church law and that was directed by the Vatican. So we have to be very careful in how we talk about history, that we don't acquiesce to that retelling of it in a way that just tells a lie, that repeats a lie. The truth matters. The truth matters now, but the truth will matter even more in the future when people look back on history and hopefully not look back, you know, as I've done across two millennia, frankly, of revelations of these kind of scandals within the church, that they survived and that they got over, because as far as they're concerned, they don't think in years or in decades or even in centuries. They think in terms of millennia. And the one thing they know is that they endure and that they can restate the truth, and that too often we'll all accept it. The truth matters. And we should always be prepared to stand for truth, because without truth, there can be no justice.
Colm O'Gorman, thank you very much. Colm O'Gorman, founder and, of course, former director of One in Four.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.